President Obama is talking with small business owners, Wall Street, middle-class taxpayers, House Speaker Boehner consulting with some of the same executives. But where are the face-to-face negotiations to avert the fiscal cliff? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll discuss this hour how each party is approaching the coming fiscal cliff. Also, the continued controversy over U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice's comments following the attack on the Libyan consulate, and the future of the Iowa straw poll. Our analysts, Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. Politics Day on River to River starts right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday here on the program, a time when we check out the political landscape, look back, find out, analyze what's happened in the recent past in our politics, and also look forward. And joining us to do that today, Stephen Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
Great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Very good. I'm glad you got rid of that frog in your throat. Wayne Moyer with us by phone. Maybe he has a frog for us, too. Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben. Good to be here.
Well, we want to get to a number of things. Of course, the fiscal cliff, a big issue to talk about a little bit later. Before that, we want to talk about the controversy surrounding Ambassador Susan Rice. And first of all, the future of the Ames straw poll, if we may do that. First of all, Governor Branstad continues to call for the end of the Ames straw poll, an Iowa GOP fundraiser. It's been considered an early test for Republican candidates in advance of the Iowa caucuses. It was his weekly news conference this past Monday that the governor said participants in the straw poll are not representative of participants in the caucuses.
It's not representative. And clearly the results have shown that in recent times, because the people that won the straw polls have not won the caucuses, and the caucuses are what's most important.
Branstad says ultimately the candidates will determine if the straw poll will continue, and traditionally it's held in Ames a few months before the caucuses. Branstad says many Iowans are also questioning its relevancy. Now, Stephen Schmidt, I know you have an opinion on it. You wrote in your latest blog for WNYC, but remind us what the straw poll is set up to do, what purpose it serves, how it works.
First of all, it's a fundraiser for the Republicans, and it's brilliant. It raises a ton of money for the party, so I think that's fantastic for any party. Number two, it occurs during the dead zone of news. Not much happens during August, in the summer, before the political season really begins and other things happen. And so it gives the news media and others a wonderful event. Number three, it's sort of a carnival. I mean, it's a political fair where one of the only places where people can actually have fun in politics, because the rest of it is grim and it's money-driven negative campaigning. This is money-driven great fried chicken and ribs and good bands. And so it's a festival where people can enjoy politics and, spend an afternoon or a day meeting some of the candidates, some of the people who think they could be president. And it's been very successful, and it is now a tradition, and I like traditions.
Now, we want to get our listeners' opinions. If people out there thinking about the straw poll, perhaps you've participated in it. What do you think? Has it outlived its usefulness? Should it live on? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, tweet us at IPR Talk. We're also on Facebook. So the point that Governor Branstad makes, that the people who have won this straw poll in recent years have not won the caucuses. That's what's important. You write in your blog for WNYC, the Ames straw poll is Woodstock for politicos. Don't kill it. What do you mean?
Well, I think it's just that. It is an event. It's a media event. It's a festival. The other thing is,
But if the people who win that, Michelle Bachmann, I believe last time, don't go on to win the caucuses, doesn't that make it look bad, our state bad?
Ooh. I'm going to spring it on you right now. My next blog is a response to Governor Branstad about the Iowa caucuses. In 79, George Herbert Walker Bush won the Iowa caucuses, but Ronald Reagan became the Republican nominee and became president. In 87, Bob Dole won the Iowa caucuses, but George W. Bush won the nomination and went on to become president. In 1999, it was a wash because Bush was running again. But in 2007, Mike Huckabee won the Iowa caucuses, but John McCain became the candidate of the...
So are you saying they're both irrelevant?
I don't want to say that. I'm saying both are relevant, but I'm saying that the caucuses have as bad a track record in identifying the winner for the Republican Party in particular than the Ames Straw Poll. And when you start opening that Pandora's box that something is not accurate, the first thing the media does, and I've had several calls, is saying the caucuses are actually nothing but a straw poll, first of all, because no delegates are really selected in the caucuses. And secondly, the caucuses have gotten it wrong as many or more times than the Ames Straw Poll. So be careful what you wish for when you want to do away with something that is considered not to identify correctly the final candidate for the Republican Party.
So it's good for us in Iowa, so we should be for it.
I love it.
Okay. Wayne Moyer, what's your view on this?
I think unless there's more consensus among the Republican leadership to do away with the straw poll, it's likely to be back. And then it will depend whether the candidates themselves, and my suspicion is that they will want the exposure. So I think there is even with Branstad being opposed to it, I think there is a decent chance that it'll be back.
Republican Party Chairman A.J. Spiker disagreeing with the governor. He calls it the best way for a presidential campaign to organize for the caucuses. So the determination of whether the Iowa straw poll lives or dies will rest on what, Stefan?
Well, it's going to be the Republican Party leadership, and they are not necessarily Governor Branstad. I mean, you've got to remember that the Republican Party in Iowa came out with a very interesting result, which was that the Ron Paul people kind of took control of a lot of the Republican Party. And they love things like the straw poll because that's where candidates who are not the pick of the party elite have a chance to go and talk and get their message out. And, you know, Michelle Bachmann won in 2011 and got her message out, and that was wonderful for her. The Democrats certainly would like the straw poll to continue if people like Michelle Bachmann come out as the winners.
Okay. Let's move on to a second on our agenda, the Susan Rice controversy. Ambassador Susan Rice, U.N. ambassador, yesterday met with her harshest Republican critics. Rice came under fire for her handling of a news conference after the attacks on the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi, Libya. That was an attack that claimed the lives of three Americans. Senator John McCain is one of those critics. In an interview on Fox News yesterday, he said the answers Ambassador Rice gave about Benghazi were inadequate, especially given her access to information about the attack.
Lots of classified information that she gets briefed on daily that indicated that this was not a hateful video that sparked a spontaneous demonstration. I still don't understand why anyone would believe when you come with mortars and rocket-propelled grenades, how that could possibly be viewed as a spontaneous demonstration. So there's a lot of layers to this onion.
Senator McCain went on to say he would be hard-pressed to support Ambassador Rice if she is nominated to be the next Secretary of State. River to River listeners, what do you think? It's been in the news, this Benghazi attack. Do you think it is worth exploring more, getting to the bottom of it, if there is something other than what it appears to be, which is just chaos at the beginning of a surprise attack? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Wayne, what was supposed to be a make nice meeting yesterday seemed only to have made things worse. What do you see going on here?
Well, I think this is interesting. Is this really an issue, as some people are saying, that Susan Rice or somebody close to her changed the story that they were getting from intelligence prior to her appearances on national television to protect the president's images in being strong against terrorism. Or, and I'm leaning in this direction, I think Lindsey Graham and John McCain want John Kerry to be Secretary of State, both because they're very close and because if Kerry goes from the Senate to the Department of State, there'll be another election in Massachusetts, and Scott Brown, who just lost the recent election, would a Republican, will be a good candidate to take Kerry's place. And so I think part of what's going on is sort of get Kerry as Secretary of State rather than Susan Rice, who they see as the president's candidate. And so by undercutting Rice at this stage of the game, maybe putting pressure on the president to nominate Kerry.
Let me ask you this, Wayne. Strategically, though, how wise is it for a party that, well, didn't do well with women or minorities in the election to wage a drawn-out campaign against a black woman, highly thought of, perhaps the next Secretary of State?
I think it's extremely risky. And unless they have something about Susan Rice that they could bring up in confirmation hearings that would undercut her, I think then they're in really bad position, because all of this will come out, and the things that you're talking about in terms of congressional bias against particularly African American women in this position, I think might undermine the Republican position.
Your thoughts on this, Stephen Schmidt?
I agree, and the other thing that you should keep in mind is essentially that, and this to be purely politically crass, I mean, most Americans don't want Congress to spend its time on this. This is not a top issue with most Americans. They would like to see the next topic that you're going to probably raise for us to discuss, the fiscal cliff, jobs, the economy, Social Security, Medicare, and how to unravel ourselves and get ourselves out of Afghanistan and get out of the Middle East. Those are the things that people are interested in. And this is inside Washington, inside baseball. And I think most people don't want the time spent on that, don't want the media to concentrate on it, don't want John McCain and the other Republicans to waste a lot of time on this. And I think most people feel that, you know, there's so much violence around the world. People are killed. Things are blown up. If you had a hearing every time about why something happened and who knew what when, that Congress would do nothing else but that. And so I think it's odd that the Republicans, maybe they just don't want to face the fiscal cliff and sit down and negotiate. And this is, you know, a nice way to do it. Maybe they still have the theme that we're going to make sure Obama doesn't have any victories and doesn't win anything. And yes, I agree that maybe they would like John Kerry out. And Scott Brown is unemployed right now, the former senator, the current but now voted out senator of Massachusetts. And I guess he's got large numbers of yard signs that say, you know, Scott Brown for Senate. So it can be a very cost-effective campaign.
A repurposed yard sign, perhaps. Stan in Altoona with us. Hi, Stan.
Hi. My comment is that I think that the outrage that John McCain and Lindsey Graham are expressing over the Benghazi situation is really deceitful on their part. Where was their outrage when the Bush administration deceived us and brought us into a war where thousands and thousands of Americans died and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were killed? It seems, although this is a tragic situation in Benghazi, that these people are just doing it strictly for political gain.
Okay. Thank you for that view, Stan, calling from Altoona. Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about the fiscal cliff issue, since we'll get into that now and then continue on after the break. We want to hear from our listeners. We had it in the top of the hour's news. Where do you, River to River listeners, stand on the fiscal cliff issue? Should taxes be raised on the wealthiest among us? The American public seems to overwhelmingly favor raising taxes on the rich. as a way to pay down the deficit while opposing a hike in Medicare eligibility age or eliminating tax deductions. This is, according to a new poll released today, 6 in 10 Americans support raising the marginal tax rate on income above $250,000. That's according to this new Washington Post ABC poll. Only 37% oppose a tax hike. 73% of Democrats, 63% of independents support such a move. 59% of Republicans oppose it. Even those in this poll making over $100,000 a year support a hike, 57 to 42%. Join our discussion for the rest of the hour as we talk about the fiscal cliff, the 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Well, while members of Congress are doing a lot of talking about reaching a deal to avoid this so-called fiscal cliff, where they're not talking much to each other. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says Democrats and President Obama need to stop campaigning and start working.
As we head into the fiscal cliff negotiations, my advice to the president would be, it seems like our friends on the other side are having some difficulty kind of turning off the campaign. We need to sit down and work this matter out. I think we have a clear sense that there's an opportunity here at the end of the year to do something important for the country.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid agrees that so far much of what's being tossed around by Republicans is nice rhetoric, but what's needed is a concrete deal.
We had a meeting with the four leaders up here in the White House. It went very well. The problem, that was before Thanksgiving, after the election, and since that time there's been little progress with the Republicans, which is a disappointment to me. They've talked some happy talk about doing revenues, but we only have a couple weeks to get something done. So we have to get away from the happy talk and start talking about specific things.
As part of the ongoing budget negotiations, some Republicans have begun to back away from the no new taxes pledge of Grover Norquist and his Americans for Tax Reform. Some have said they'd be willing to abandon that pledge in an effort to reduce the deficit. This morning, perhaps you heard on Morning Edition, Norquist expressed skepticism that a deal could be reached that would cause congressional Republicans like Senator Lindsey Graham to accept a tax increase.
He imagines that the Democrats will agree to fundamental reform of entitlement, something they haven't done in, 60 years. But we imagine that they're going to. We imagine a pink unicorn. Now, if you had a pink unicorn, how many dollars in taxes would you raise to trade for the pink unicorn? Since pink unicorns do not exist in the real world, it has never occurred to me to worry about the senator from South Carolina. He's not going to vote for a deal because the kind of 10-to-1 ratio deal he's talking about with real ironclad spending cuts is never going to happen.
Stephen Schmidt, I'll give you first crack at this, then on to Wayne. Where are we with this fiscal cliff and the posturing, I guess you could say?
A game of chicken, and we've talked about it before. The question is, you know, even if you are a great fan of chicken and you're driving down an abandoned road or runway in your Chevy Camaro straight at the car coming at you, at some point one of you is going to have to turn the wheel.
What's going on, though? We don't have face-to-face negotiations. About 30 days away from going over this cliff. The players are not talking to each other. What are they doing?
It's plenty of time. 30 days is an eternity. Have you done your Christmas shopping yet? I mean, the truth of the matter is what Obama is doing, and the Republicans are beating him up and saying he's still in campaign mode, he's doing exactly what Ronald Reagan did. Ronald Reagan went around Congress and went directly to the American voters. It's surprising that Obama hasn't had a national speech in which he lays out why his approach to the fiscal cliff is the only one that will make things work and use his charm and so on to go around Congress and directly to public opinion. That's what he's doing now. He's going around the country trying to build public support for it. And the more of that he does, the Republicans are tail between their legs after the election. And they, you know, they don't have the cards in their hands. And I talked to a couple of people in the last 2 days who say the worst thing that could happen to the Republicans is that we go over the cliff, because the country, in every poll that we've seen, says the Republicans are the ones who are obstructionists, and so they can't afford to. So they will at some point again sit down with President Obama and with the Democrats and the Republicans and all of them will work out something that is viable in which there will be some tax increases or a change in the deductions for people with incomes over $250,000 or $500,000 the way Warren Buffett said it might be done.
Yeah, Wayne Moyer.
What we're getting right now is what we expect posturing. Each side is trying to backstop its own bargaining position. And I'm not at all surprised by it, and I'm not at all concerned by it.
Yeah.
What was really important is what's going on behind the scenes, and this is what we don't really know. And my guess is there is some pretty serious negotiation going on, but both sides are really very quiet about it. They don't want it to come out until a deal is reached. So I would expect the fighting to go on almost to the last minute, and then and then a deal be made at that point.
Okay.
I agree.
is either party, in this case, is it appealing for either party to dive off that fiscal cliff? Is either one, you think, seriously considering as an option?
I don't think so. I think the uncertainty is so great that I don't think either party would want to take that risk.
Let's go to Patrick in Cedar Rapids. Patrick has a view on this. Hi, Patrick. Coming up on a break, what's on your mind here?
Well, I'm a small business owner, and I'm completely in agreement that this is probably going on behind the scenes, but I'd like to see Simpson-Bowles enacted as the both parties and candidates got behind it during the election, and suddenly as things happen, the rhetoric ceases after the election. But I would hope Simpson-Bowles is being enacted. That includes some higher taxes on the wealthy. It is a combination of cuts, and all the rhetoric is, yes, we need both cuts and we need revenue, and Simpson-Bowles encompasses both. So it seems to be a logical outcome that they would get behind it. But there's nothing logical about Washington politics, but that would be my hope.
Okay, Patrick, thank you for your view. Stefan, tell us, Simpson-Bowles, how has each party embraced it, or to what degree?
Well, it's a bipartisan thing. The person who abandoned Simpson-Bowles at one point has actually been President Obama. He's got to come back if Simpson-Bowles is going to be the compromise. And it would actually be, it's kind of like when you have base closings in the United States, military base closings, nobody wants to close any bases. And so instead of closing bases, what has happened in the past is a commission is appointed. That commission is given the power to close unnecessary or obsolete military facilities. No one can go in and tweak it and say, well, yes, let's close the bases, but not the one in my state. And the bases are closed, and then the commission can be blamed for it, and the members of Congress and the president walk away with their hands clean. And I think it may very well be that Simpson-Bowles is the equivalent of the base closing commissions, which is, in the end, they may turn to it and say, this is about the best we can do. We hate it. We don't want it. It raises too many taxes, the Republicans will say. It cuts too many programs, Obama will say. But it's the only thing we can do. It could be that it'll end that way.
Okay, we'll be back in just a minute with more Politics Wednesday. Stefan Schmidt of the Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, continue to talk about the fiscal cliff issue, other issues too. And we'd like you to join our conversation. Should, for instance, entitlements such as Social Security and Medicare be on the chopping block when we try to solve these fiscal problems? Weigh in on it, won't you? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Back with more Politics Wednesday on River to River after a short break. This is Iowa Public Radio. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Even though slavery was outlawed generations ago, people are still imprisoned and exploited in this country. Often they're teens hoping to escape a difficult home life, but wind up in the hands of predatory men who sell them for sex. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about human trafficking. Yes, also here in Iowa and nationwide, and efforts to stop it tomorrow at this time. Today, it's Politics Wednesday. We have the pleasure of having Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College with us, Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University, and you with your questions, your opinion, 1-866-780-9100, talking this hour about the fiscal cliff issue, the Susan Rice controversy, her handling, her comments after the attack in Benghazi, Libya, also the future of the Ames straw poll. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Let's check in with one of our listeners, Dave in Walcott. Hi, Dave.
Afternoon, gentlemen. Yes, I found it amusing that your guest basically says that if they don't, Republicans don't vote for Susan Rice, they'll disenfranchise the African female voters. Well, considering they're not voting Republican to begin with, and when you think about it, because she's either incompetent or a liar. And then if you look at what Condoleezza Rice did and what the African female voters did for the Republican Party, I find it rather amusing that it doesn't really matter what they do. They're not going to vote for them anyway. And with the fiscal cliff, my understanding, you got to have an edge. And to have an edge, you have to have a budget. And we haven't had a budget in 4 years.
Okay.
This country's going. This country's going.
Okay, Dave, thank you for your comment from Walcott. Let's get reaction, perhaps to you, Wayne, on the Susan Rice comment. We had Condoleezza Rice in there, too. So is it really an important issue for the GOP and the party as a whole going forward?
I think the big thing that the GOP would hope to get out of this would be to undercut Obama's foreign policy leadership, undercut this image that he's been successful against terrorists. But my own view is that I wonder really whether that's what's going on in McCain's head, or more it's to get John Kerry in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Ben is joining us in Des Moines. Ben, as you listen to this hour, what's on your mind?
I've been looking at the idea of the impasse between the two parties, and I had the opportunity to get to know one of the negotiators in the Northern Ireland peace process, and they used this story of there being this narrow bridge, and there's a bus coming from either side of the bridge, and both bus drivers want to get their people across, you know, but it wasn't until the people on the bus said, you know, it's okay, just back up a little bit, and, you know, it's okay to back up, you know, we'll give in a little bit to be able to get across eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the Democrats need to give in a little bit about entitlements, and the Republicans need to give in a little bit about taxes, and the people have spoken. You know, we know what we want,
right.
And the politicians have to start getting it done.
Well, Ben, for you in Des Moines, are you willing to put entitlements, Social Security, Medicare on the table? Do you feel that's
sure? I think there's got to be some creativity about it. There's got to be some way. You know, we can't have our cake and eat it too all the time. So I'm a Democrat, but I'm willing to go there somehow.
Okay, thank you for your view, Ben from Des Moines. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk a little bit about the Norquist pledge. For decades, a conservative lobbyist, Grover Norquist, has vowed to drive Republicans out of office if they didn't pledge to oppose tax increases, and many lawmakers have signed on. Now, some lawmakers are backing away from that pledge. I wonder, Stefan Schmidt, is Norquist becoming less relevant, losing power?
Well, I think he's had a great run. You know, he's been the shadow figure, the Rasputin kind of the Republican Party. He's hiding behind the curtain with a shotgun or something, and all the Republicans seem to be scared to death of him. And I wrote a blog saying that my students in my class asked me, who the hell is, you know, this guy, and why does he have so much influence over the second party in the United States? And that's a question I think that Americans are starting to ask now. I mean, Grover Norquist is a nobody. You know, he is a kind of political terrorist who has scared the heck out of the Republicans. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why they've been losing elections is because you can't make a pledge and say this is a pledge forever. You know, people don't even do that when they get married. And so a lot of the Republicans apparently are seeing the fact that everything that you do in government is a negotiation, and it involves negotiating revenue increases and tax cuts and tax increases and spending cuts. And you don't ever put everything on the table, and you never say, read my lips, no new taxes, which is basically what Grover Norquist did. Is he took George H.W. Bush's campaign pledge, read my lips, no new taxes, and he put it on a piece of paper and made Republicans sign it. And that's a completely idiotic thing to do, because, you know, if we ever got into a war, for example, the war in Afghanistan and Iraq should have been financed through tax increases and should have been put on budget. The reason it was done off budget and increased our national debt and our deficit is because of the tax pledge that meant that we couldn't raise taxes to fight those wars. And when you raise taxes to fight a war, then you got to go explain it to the people whose rates you're raising. And, you know, I think if it isn't now, the era of Grover Norquist is going to come to an end pretty soon.
Let me just add this. I think that the debate over the deficit has sort of changed the policy agenda in a way. I think now it's almost impossible for people to think that we can solve the deficit problem without raising taxes. Mm-hmm. And I think that, to go along with what Stefan has said, is helping to undercut Norquist.
And the polling that we've done, the new one that I mentioned earlier in the hour, seems to support that. Let's go to Rick in Iowa City. Rick, you're on River to River. What's on your mind?
Yeah, this is concerning the governing, not exactly what we're talking about, but I was wondering what the guests thought the possibility or probability that Harry Reid may pull the changing of the filibuster on the first day of the next session.
Oh, this is interesting, yes. Related to what we're talking about, but we haven't touched on it yet this hour. Stefan, could you tell us about what Senator Reid is proposing here about the filibuster in the Senate?
Well, the problem is not the filibuster itself, but it's the threat of a filibuster, which has been used to paralyze almost every single law in the Senate that, in this case, the Republicans are the minority, so they're the ones who are using it. When they don't like something that's coming up, they threaten to filibuster, and that seems to be enough to essentially then paralyze the Senate. And so Harry Reid is saying this is essentially legislative blackmail, and he would like to change it so that you actually have to essentially go back to actually having a filibuster in the traditional sense, and you can't just threaten to do it. I'm not exactly sure what he's proposing. The Republicans are already screaming that, mm-hmm. you know, that this is going to be a killer for any negotiations on the fiscal cliff, and that he's using this to give power to the Democrats, who have a majority now still in the Senate. And so it's not only a rules change that's being debated, but it is highly political, because the Republicans have had victories in the Senate, not because they have a majority, but because they have been able to essentially deter legislative action by threatening to use, you know, the endless talking, which is what a filibuster is.
Kirk joins us from Iowa City. Kirk, what is on your mind, politically speaking?
I was thinking about how he started this pledge, Grover Norquist started this pledge 20 years ago. And so I kind of thought back in presidential terms, and we go 4-4 Obama, 8 for Bush, and 8 for Clinton. And that gets us back to when he made the pledge. And Clinton is the only president in a very long time anyway who had us in the black and had us balanced. And so, you know, back when that pledge was made, it really didn't amount to much, because there wasn't much to lose. Mm-hmm. And so now we're in a completely different situation. And so it's fine to say that kind of thing when everything's going well, but now it's just not the smartest move.
Kirk,
that was my comment.
Thank you from Iowa City. A couple of other things. As we speak, it's interesting that the White House announcing just this morning that perhaps as we speak, President Obama and former campaign rival Mitt Romney lunching together at the White House, fulfilling an offer that Obama made, if you remember, in that re-election victory speech, an event closed to reporters and photographers. Anything more here you see, Wayne, than simply keeping a victory promise? Any substance between these two men?
I doubt it. I remember after the 2008 election, Obama and McCain got together for lunch or coffee or something like that. So I think it's part of the civility, if you would, of politics. I doubt if they'll go much further than that.
Mm-hmm. Another sort of celebrating the peaceful transition of power.
I think it could be an announcement coming out that Obama is choosing Mitt Romney as his candidate for Secretary of State.
I doubt that.
I'm listening to the tone of your voice, and I don't think you're quite being serious. But
you never know what's going to happen in D.C., I'll tell you that.
What is, Stefan, Mitt Romney's future role in the GOP now that he's had a long chase after the presidency?
A fundraiser. And fund giver. I don't think that he's going to run for anything, honestly. It's why should he? You know, this guy has more money than Cretius. And he's got, you know, three homes and six cars and a car elevator and a dressage horse. And, you know, politics is nasty and people expose everything that you've done and they criticize you and they want you to reveal your taxes. Why should somebody like Mitt Romney do that? He can do many other things. Maybe he can start a philanthropy and finally give some of that excessive wealth that he has squirreled away in these bank accounts and give it to good charities and start a foundation, you know, find religion, so to speak, that when you're wealthy in this country, Bill Gates, it took Bill Gates quite a while, and when he finally discovered it, wow, did he go for it 100%? You are only respected if you use that wealth for the public good, the common good, and to help make things in this world better. You don't get credit from most people except your buddies at the club for having it in bank accounts in Switzerland and the Cayman Islands. And I think maybe he'll learn that lesson.
One other loose end I want to make sure we touch on this hour from the election. Since President Obama was reelected earlier this month, we've heard about the flurry of secession petitions from the states being created, notably Texas, more than 115,000 signatures from that state, far exceeding the 25,000 signatures needed for an official White House response. Critics say it's just disgruntled voters upset that the former GOP presidential nominee Mitt Romney lost. Ron Paul, interesting comment here. Congressman Paul said it was deeply American principle of secession, and it must be an option used as leverage to make sure the government doesn't encroach on American liberties. Wayne, how seriously should we take this expression of discontent with the union here?
Not too seriously, I think. I think this is a pressure relief valve. There are a lot of people who are unhappy about the election, and this is a way of expressing their unhappiness, I think. Mm-hmm. I think what's really important in terms of what would happen in the long term are what the interests of these states are. And Texas, for instance, gets an enormous amount of money from the federal government, and there would be enormous negative implications if Texas were to sever its relationship with the rest of the country, all the military bases, for instance, that are in Texas. And I think deep down, the people who are really important in Texas would be very reluctant to let this get very far.
We have to mention, too, don't we, that if we would tally how many presidents come from how many states, Texas would come out on top or near the top, wouldn't they, Stefan?
Yes, that's true, and I kind of agree that this is, you know, this is Texan nationalism. You know, they were an independent country for a short period of time. There is a long history in Texas of, you know, being sort of independent, and Rick Perry himself, the governor, has said and was criticized during the primary and caucus season for having said that maybe Texas needs to become independent. And I would remind everyone that we never think that countries fall apart and parts of them split off and become independent countries or entities, especially in the United States. But Scotland is about to make some decision about gaining independence from the UK, Catalonia is making a decision of whether the Basque country is going to separate from Spain, which I think both are realistic. Quebec is an area of Canada that has always had an itch and an urge to be autonomous. And so we have to be very careful not to think that the union of the 50 states is like the tax pledge forever and ever and ever. Countries come together. Nobody ever could have predicted that the United States would look like it looks today in 1700 or in 1500. And countries change and fall apart for various reasons. And I don't think this is the moment, but there is a lot of nationalism out there in various places where people really feel that the federal government doesn't represent them and that it doesn't matter how much money you get from the federal government. I mean, third world countries very often really don't care that they're getting a lot of aid from the United States if they feel oppressed and that Americans are pushing them around and telling them what to do. Just look at Afghanistan.
Gary is joining us. Gary, I don't see where you're calling from. Where are you?
Iowa City.
Okay, Gary, go ahead. We have just a couple minutes left.
Yes. As a senior citizen, I've been around long enough to remember the days when we had higher taxes, and in my view, the best times were during those years. And so I have no problem with this fiscal cliff situation with us raising taxes. First of all, the $250,000 isn't on the raise isn't on the first $250,000. Everybody pays the same rate on the $250,000, so it's only the people that make more than that that have to pay this ultra tax.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's more than fair. It's not going to affect the jobs. Jobs are created from demand and not by people. People respond to the demand.
Okay. And you're not worried about the massive sequestration cuts, the Defense Department, other cuts in the budget?
In the military?
In the military, also in other programs. Just a meat cleaver to it, rather than selecting carefully what should be cut?
Well, I don't think we need to cut any more from Medicare. I believe we did quite a bit last year on that deal. And Social Security isn't involved in the debt. It's a separate situation.
Okay.
So, yeah, I don't know that we need to take a meat cleaver to everything, but
okay.
I think we should do it more carefully than that, but we definitely can cut some of the fat out of the military and do some other things.
Okay, Gary, we're running out of time, so I'm going to move on to thank you very much, Gary, from Iowa City. Let's move to Rich in Waterloo before our time runs out. What's on your mind, Gary? Rich?
Hi. On my mind is you ought to leave Social Security alone.
Okay.
If I would get a return on what I had paid in and the government hadn't been robbing Social Security, we'd all be in better shape. But every time they needed money and they could find it no place else, they stole it from us. Nope. If you leave that alone, and at the same time, I think that we got to keep our country strong. And I don't believe that these robot aircraft,
the drones,
is like the traditional line in France. They'll eventually shoot them down, and as a result, we won't be able to manufacture them fast enough because we've gotten rid of our manufacturing base.
Rich in Waterloo,
I'll hang up.
Thank you for those thoughts. As we leave here, we have a minute or two left. Stefan, Wayne, maybe some thoughts on the 113th Congress to be. Wayne Moyer.
Well, I think part of the deficit reduction tax getting over the fiscal cliff is going to be left to that Congress. I think we're going to get an interim deal at the end of this year. There are going to be some spending cuts and some assurances of tax increases. My guess is the spending cuts will probably come at least in part from the president's medical programs, part of the health care bill, that they will not come from Medicare per se in the first go-round. And I suspect that military will not be much involved in the first round, but there'll be some assurances, and then the new Congress is going to have to deal with the big cuts and with the tax increase.
Okay, Stephen Schmidt, a minute to look into your crystal ball.
Yeah, and Warren Buffett is going to be a great help, because Warren Buffett keeps saying, I don't care, raise my taxes. You know, he says, you know, people like me, we don't even notice it when you raise our taxes. We've got so much money, it doesn't change our lifestyle one bit. It doesn't make us unhappy. We're not going to run to lawyers and try to hide even more money in Belize and other places. You know, we used to pay 91% when Eisenhower was president. We were rich as anything. And countries like Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Germany, Holland, Belgium have much higher taxes than we do. And their standard of living is extremely high, and people are much happier. And so countries where taxes are really low, if you go look at the index, are countries where life is hell. And some of the countries where taxes are high, life is more secure and people are better off. So the idea that taxes are a terrible thing is a myth.
Stephen Schmidt, thank you for being with us this hour, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
And Wayne Moyer, thank you, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Thanks for joining us by phone.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. In Ames, help from Alyssa Weiss. And the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about human trafficking here in Iowa and nationwide. Also, efforts to stop it tomorrow on this program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.